It wasn't that many years ago that a meandering drive from Medford to Grants Pass would take you past three dams on the Rogue River. Today, all three are gone. Gold Ray Dam, Gold Hill Dam, and Savage Rapids all bit the dust, or hit the drink if you prefer, over the last dozen years. Yes, it's a trend. For further proof, see the Klamath River, where plans to remove four dams are moving ahead. We get a look at the move from dam construction to dam removal in a new book by Peter Brewitt called Same River Twice: The Politics of Dam Removal and River Restoration. It focuses on three major cases in the Northwest, and Savage Rapids is one of the cases. Peter Brewitt is an assistant professor of environmental studies at Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina. His teaching and research focuses on the politics of ecological restoration. Peter Brewitt, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So when we talk about the politics of ecological restoration, this sounds like a very deep vein to mine.
I would say so. It's something that always keeps me interested.
Yeah, a lot of stuff to work with there. So not only is this book from Oregon State University Press, but your attention is very focused, as I mentioned, on this region. Tell us about your wife Kim's doctoral work here.
Oh, well, my wife is a fish ecologist, and it was through her work that I got interested in dam removal. She was looking at the dynamics of steelhead in the Klamath and how they go back and forth between cool tributaries, where it's more comfortable for them, and the main stem of the river, which is uncomfortably hot but has a lot of food. So once she signed on to that, or her first year in graduate school, I heard about the Klamath dam removals, and I had never thought about the idea that you would actually take out a dam. I knew about the controversies with building them. So when I went up there, when she was doing her field work, I poked around the area a little bit and got to hear about all these other things that were happening, and took off from there. So together we spent three or four seasons in and around the Klamath.
That response is really interesting, though, that even for you, as much as you study these issues, that the idea of taking a dam out was pretty foreign at the beginning.
There's not many things that are as, I don't want to say ignorant, that have as much to learn as a first year PhD student. I knew a lot less then than I do now. And also in those years, the last, 10 years it's been, dam removal has become a lot more normal. I mean, this would have been 2009, I suppose. So Savage Rapids was just coming out. The Elwha dams weren't out yet. Just a lot was happening right then, and I was fortunate to be situated right in the thick of it.
All right. It's not just contemporary stuff you deal with. There's quite a bit of history in the book, too. And mm-hmm. One particularly cool section caught my eye, that dam removal is mentioned in the Magna Carta.
Yeah. One of the central question in the book and in almost any issue around rivers is, what do we do with our rivers? And almost everyone has their priorities for how the waterway and how the water and how the things that live there ought to be managed and what they think is most important. And so back to medieval England, there was fish passage, essentially, or the desire to catch fish, and then there is navigability. And they didn't have the kind of industry that we have now, but one use counteracted the other, and they had to wrangle over it then. And it continues to this day.
It's weird to think about the fact that there was dam removal thought of in the 13th century, because from that time to this one, pretty much, the removal of a dam was the exception, not the rule. Mm-hmm. How brisk a pace have we undertaken in building dams in this country over the time that people have arrived from Europe?
Really as fast as we can, until very recently. As soon as immigrants from Europe arrived in North America, there was the desire to control waterways for kind of early industrial mills, for navigability, and that sort of thing. And that only increased as technology got better and as Europeans and then later Americans made their way out across the continent.
As has been pointed out, the white settlement of the American West more or less demanded dams. It was Mark Hatfield, former governor and senator from Oregon, who said it was water impoundment that won the West. You give one dam credit for igniting the environmental movement. Tell us about Hetch Hetchy and what happened there.
Well, so Hetch Hetchy is a valley that's in Yosemite National Park, north of the more famous Yosemite Valley, and looks quite similar, and has a big granite cliffs and high waterfalls and so on. But toward the beginning of the 20th century, the city of San Francisco, which had grown enormously in the 50 or so years since the Gold Rush, didn't have an adequate supply of its own water. I mean, San Francisco is on a peninsula. It had many more people than it, than the rainfall and streams in that area could handle. There was fears about fire because the San Francisco earthquake, the famous one in the early part of the 20th century, had caused fires as well as shaking destruction. So they looked around and they found this valley, which for a dam site was just about perfect. I'm not an engineer, but that's my understanding. Pure water upstream, impermeable granite walls, no people living there to speak of, a narrow pinch at the foot to put the dam in. So that seemed like a great reservoir for the city. I should say that most of the rivers in California, or in the middle part, flow into the San Francisco Bay Delta, so the gravity took the water there as well. But it was in a national park, and that didn't quite mean the same thing that a national park does now in the popular consciousness, but still, it was clearly not supposed to be developed in this way. So whether this should be an exception or what sparked massive controversy, the kind of things that we think of now when we think of wrangling over, the spotted owl or pipelines more recently, those kinds of environmental political battles. More or less the first really big famous one was over whether or not Hetch Hetchy should be dammed. John Muir, the famous environmental writer, explorer, advocate, and the Sierra Club, which had started a few years before that time and had pretty much been a group of hiking friends, became political and fought with the city over it. And eventually, of course, Hetch Hetchy was dammed. You can go there and see the dam today if you want.
Some rumor that this might have hastened John Muir's death?
It's romantical to say that. They say that there are people who say he died of a broken heart. At the same time, he was old and unwell. But at the same, I'm not that kind of doctor, but I do think that terrible disappointment can have a physical effect on your well-being, and I wouldn't be surprised if that contributed a bit to his dying the next year after the deal was signed.
So we were just talking about Hetch Hetchy and how that certainly soured the last year or two of John Muir's life, the fact that the dam was built in Yosemite National Park. Dams went up for decades more. We had quite a love affair going on here. Glen Canyon Dam, though, built more recently. You mentioned this as a sore spot for environmentalists. Why is it so?
Well, I think that I'd say two reasons. One is that it was well-publicized. Edward Abbey, the famous novelist, gadfly, contrarian, featured Glen Canyon critically in a couple of his more successful books, and that really caught the attention of the growing environmental movement in the 60s, 70s, and then into today. So people got to hear about it, but the other thing was that the Glen Canyon Dam inundated Glen Canyon, which by all accounts was one of the most beautiful stretches of country in the entire Southwest. So the sense of loss surrounding that, and the sense of there being this underwater, although it's, some of it's exposed when there's droughts, this lost world really caught people's ideals.
And the big dams, as you point out, make easy and obvious targets. I mean, it's easy to feel like, wow, but the things really changed, Glen Canyon when this dam went up. But you also talk about small dams and how important they can be across the landscape. And there are a lot of them out there, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. So there are about 2.5 million dams in this country, depending on whose estimate you look at. And the overwhelming majority of them are little dams, 5 or 6 foot dams on rivers that are not known at all outside of their immediate area. And cumulatively, those little dams make a huge difference in their watersheds as they stop sediment, change flows, change temperatures, and bar migration upstream and downstream. So really, I would say that those small dams, a lot of which are really not especially useful compared to a big dam on the main stem of a big river, ought to get more attention. And amongst the river restoration community, it seems like they do.
Well, we've seen several examples around here, tributaries to the Rogue River, for example, upstream from Grants Pass in northwest Jackson County, a couple of dams taken out just in the last couple of years. And these seem fairly typical of the kinds of examples you cite in the book, that dams are no longer useful to owners, and they do what? They just sit there and decay?
Pretty much. I mean, it's like a river, a dam is a lot of things to a lot of people, but when you get down to it, a dam is a tool, and if you leave any tool out for decades after you stop using it, it's going to decay. So there are a lot of dams that were built for economies that have gone by. I mean, in New England and South Carolina, the mill economy is mostly past, but the dams that fired it up, spun it up, are still there, not really doing anything for any business. And so you'll see a lot of things like that where the people who use them are long gone and the dams sit there in the rivers.
Peter, I get the sense as you start moving into the politics of dam removal that it can be a bit of a study in negatives, that at least at the outset of making the case for not having a dam, it was hard to prove the negative, the benefits of no dam being there.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that hasn't happened yet, so it's got to be speculative. I mean, you can make the reasonable case that it'll be easier for salmon, you know, in the Northwest certainly, to make their way upstream, but at the same time, nobody's seen that yet. And there are a lot of different things that change salmon populations, so if somebody really wants to keep a dam, they can be very willing to believe that the real problem is fishing on the ocean. And fishing on the ocean is certainly part of the problem, but proving that everything will be great again after you take the dam out is tough, especially since people get used to the landscape that they're in. For maybe most people in America, if there's a local lake or a local swimming hole even, it's probably at least maintained by a dam. And those are the places that people love, people have fond memories of, and they think of them as natural sites despite them being, you know, really created by this tool that somebody put in the river.
Right, the idea that we used to swim and float and water ski on these nice flat bits of water, and they're gone now. This is we got a lot of fights about that, certainly with Savage Rapids Dam. Mm-hmm. Peter Bruitt's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Same River Twice, The Politics of Dam Removal and River Restoration. And so dam removal does still feel like going backwards to many people. I mean, this is we tend to think in terms of, you know, bigger, better, faster, more in our society, don't we?
Yeah, it's interesting the way that nostalgia works. I mean, there's dams are an ideological positive for a lot of people in the West, but not just in the West. Their progress and prosperity, and they harken back to the days, which in American history is short. It was not that long ago that people's grandparents maybe came and remembered building that dam, or were all excited when they decided to put it in and we were able to get hydroelectric power in rural Oregon. And those are great memories, and they matter to people. So the nostalgia that dam removal often harkens back to is for an older, wilder time before the rivers were controlled, when there were, at least by everybody's accounts, massive runs of fish and other species as well. And it's really kind of competing nostalgia, I would say.
Well, there's a good sentence you write in this portion of the book where you say a river's tale depends on who's doing the telling, and the stories can be very, very different, can't they?
Mm-hmm. In Grants Pass, I mean, you can find old postcards that would have just in the 1920s Savage Rapids Dam on them that people could send, which is a little bit odd to us now that you'd have that as the subject of a card, but at the time it was a focus of real pride for the community that it was, you know, moving on up into the industrial world.
It was interesting, though. I remember years driving back and forth from Grants Pass to Medford, and I'd occasionally go south of the river so I could stand at the dam, because the thundering water certainly made an impressive sight and sound.
I arrived after Savage Rapids Lake had gone by, but ponds and lakes are beautiful. Let's not pretend that there's no loss there. But the thing that a lot of people had and still have a hard time absorbing is that it was a lake because the irrigation district needed to hold on to the water. It was a business lake, so to speak, mm-hmm. Where it felt like a natural public space. And it was used in a lot of ways like a natural public space, but in the end, that's not what it was. And the same thing is true, you know, all across America, as reservoirs or recreational spaces as well as whatever they were actually built for.
I'll come back to Savage Rapids in a little bit. I want to talk about the Elwha and Glynne's Canyon dams. Yeah. What was the prevailing story of the Elwha River?
Well, the Elwha is a singular river. So it's in the Olympic Peninsula of northwestern Washington and flows out of the Olympic Mountains north into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And other than these two large dams, which are a few miles from the mouth, the river is almost entirely wild. Almost all of the watershed is in Olympic National Park, and so it's about as close to a real wilderness river as there is in the United States. The river had all 10 runs of salmonid, so ocean-going trout and salmon, that the Pacific has to offer, including Chinook that, by all accounts, weighed 100 pounds.
His stories are pretty amazing of people who needed to get help hauling the fish out of the river centuries ago.
I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, if you catch a Chinook nowadays, you know, it'll probably be 30 or 40 pounds. That's still a great-sized fish, but to imagine a river that had a meaningful population of fish that were three times that big is boggles the mind. Anyway, so the Elwha was an unusually rich salmon river, but the same kind of steep gradient that made the salmon have to grow so big also provided hydropower. And so in the early part of the 20th century, the Elwha Dam was built a few miles up upstream from the mouth, about 100 feet high, a little bit more. Then a few years later, the Glynne's Canyon Dam above that, and of course, salmon can jump pretty high, but they can't jump 100 feet. So after some wrangling over whether a fish passage would have to be put in or not, Thomas Aldwell, the guy who built it, figured out that he could say that he was going to build a hatchery there and collect salmon at the dam, and because it was a collection point, it didn't need a fish ladder, so that would work. But the hatchery failed a few years later, and after that, nobody really did much of anything about it. So the salmon-bearing portion of the river was shortened to just a few miles, and it was like that most of the 20th century. But over time, what had been a lot of hydropower in the early part of the 20th century looked like a lot less by the later part of the 20th century when the Northwest was cranking out hydropower from all over the region. So eventually the idea came to fruition between the Lower Elwha-Clallam tribe that lived at the mouth of the river, still lives at the mouth of the river, some environmental groups and some other advocates to try to push to get the river restored, which it quickly became clear meant taking out the dams. So that was in some ways kind of parallel to Savage Rapids in that it became an active political issue kind of in the mid-80s and then pushed in through the 90s and really only wrapped up right around 2000 when the federal government bought the dams. But there was the same kinds of questions. The lakes were beloved by some of the people locally, and also there was pushback against the idea of outsiders coming and telling people in the Olympic Peninsula what they ought to do. People were accustomed to the dams as a source of prosperity. And, eventually, as essentially both sides exhausted their different options, there were some creative ideas to bring people together, and different stakeholders melded into what I would call a mega coalition, where almost everybody who had a serious stake in the dams worked out a wide-ranging deal to take them out and ensure things like a supply of power for the paper mill in town, a supply of water for the city, and now those dams are out.
Peter Brewitt's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's written a book about dam removal with three key cases from the Northwest, including Savage Rapids Dam, which we'll talk about in detail in just a few minutes. His book is called Same River Twice, The Politics of Dam Removal and River Restoration. Your thoughts, your observations about dam removal and the politics thereof, and the science, too. Welcome on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You point out that these cases dragged on for a while, and dam removal didn't take place in a vacuum. And in the case of the Elwad Dam, the spotted owl situation was going on at the same time. Did that have any effect on what was going on with the Elwad dams?
I think that it increased animosity and fear, honestly. It made it so that environmentalists were seen as villains to some folks in the Northwest. And when environmentalists were arguing over salmon rather than owls, they kept the black hat, so to speak. Along the same lines, people who were against the environment now were seen as enemies still to the environmentalists who've been trying to fight over the spotted owl. And we saw some of the same things in Oregon as well, as the spotted owl was present, at least in the mindsets of some of the stakeholders. But I'd say that the reason that things spun out for so long is that there's really no law surrounding how you're supposed to take out a dam or when a dam's life is over, what happens. So that left a lot of space for creative political stakeholders on both sides to try new things to push whatever their case was.
Now, so the ceremony for Elwad Dam removal took place in September of 2011. Mm-hmm. Destruction after that. The claims against dam removal: lost jobs, expensive power, excessive silt. Any or all of those come true?
Let's see. On the Elwad, I'm not aware of any loss of jobs. I mean, that was something that was absolutely part of the deal from pretty early days, is that there would be no political support or public funding for dam removal if it was going to destroy jobs at the paper mill or in the city. I suppose that the number of people it took to actually run the dam, now those jobs are not there anymore, but that would presumably be offset by construction jobs and so on. Let's see, what were the other two?
Expensive power and excessive silt.
Expensive power. If a dam is producing enough power to really make a difference in the price of power, then that same dam is probably going to produce enough money to put in good fish ladders and pay for mitigation elsewhere and keep on making power. So the power that the Elwad Dam's made, or near Portland, the Bull Run Project Dam's made, really didn't amount to much in the sense of changing the price of power. I would say that dam removal has really not had any meaningful effect on the price of power. And as far as, did you say the sediment? Is that the other thing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As far as the sediment goes, that depends a lot on which dam you're talking about. In the east, especially, when there's a lot of rivers that had been used industrially for 100 or even 150 years, there's a lot of stuff in the sediment that you can't just release willy-nilly. But in the West, where most rivers, or lots more rivers at least, don't have that kind of history, I haven't heard of any big problems. I mean, in the short term, the burst of sediment, if you take out a dam, is potentially a problem. But the rivers seem, and again, there may be some individual removals out there that I'm not aware of that have had problems, but for the most part, the rivers seem to wash that away pretty quickly.
So as we move on to Savage Rapids Dam, which had several false starts, was finally breached in 2009, and I'm really impressed by the level of research. I looked at all the citations for Grants Pass Irrigation District and Grants Pass Daily Courier documents, and you kind of went crazy here. What were the basic issues of Grants Pass Irrigation District's water right that Water Watch Oregon and others challenged?
At the beginning, early in the 20th century, when GPID was founded, they had the right to irrigate I forget how many acres, but a pretty big stretch of southern Oregon. And so they had, according to the formula the state was using, they had a certain amount of cubic feet of water per second for each of their acres. It turned out that they didn't irrigate, even at their most active point, nearly as many acres as they could have, because it would be inaccessible to canals or people didn't want to farm there or what have you. And then as time went by, what had been a farming community changed into a little bit more of a mixed economy. A lot of retirees wanted to move up to Grants Pass because the weather's so pleasant there, and so eventually the irrigation district wasn't irrigating all that much agriculture. So they had a big water right, but they weren't using all that much of the water right. In addition, they had canals, I assume they still have those same canals, where the water seeped into the bed of the canal, and so that was nice for the vegetation along the banks of the canal, but wasn't really being applied by anybody to irrigate anything.
And as was pointed out at the time, a lot of the water is getting used to irrigate lawns instead of yeah. agricultural land. Peter, you arrived in Grants Pass after the dam was gone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So, I don't know. It was interesting. I still remember the first board meeting where the GPID, I was there covering it, where the mm-hmm. GPID voted to take the dam out. Mm-hmm. And what a storm of protests that created. And it just sort of rolled on from there to, you know, then new people getting onto the board and voting, yeah. no, we're going to keep it. And then on and on. You got to see this after the fact from the outside. Who did you see as the more interesting and influential figures in the process, the people?
Well, goodness, on the pro-removal side, Bob Hunter of Water Watch Oregon was the leading force of dam removal for almost the whole arc of the issue. On the side that wanted to keep the dam, the name that comes up a lot when you talk to people about this is Dennis Becklin,
yep.
who was the head of the board, chairman of the board for a couple of years in the mid-late 90s. But it wasn't certainly just him. There was controversy several years before that, before he was really involved. I'm trying to think of there's no one person that I would say it coalesced around, but Don Greenwood was influential, and Tom McMurray as well, in being involved at the GPID board. And the GPID board was really pretty torn over all of this, because on the one hand, they had the responsibility to the irrigation district to keep the water flowing, and they knew that they were going to have to pay too much to upgrade the dam and keep their water right. But on the other hand, they were members of the community too. They loved the dam, they loved the lake, and they were under a lot of kind of informal social pressure to keep it. So they tried to see if they could manage to do both for a while.
And it didn't happen. I'm curious to know, and you bring this up, that there's a bit of context here again. You know, things don't happen in a vacuum. Did the process of stopping the construction and completion of Elk Creek Dam and ultimately getting it notched on a Rogue River tributary many miles upstream have some bearing on what happened at Savage Rapids?
People certainly lump them together in terms of the different sides. I mean, I don't think there was anybody that I can remember who was in favor of taking out Elk Creek but wanted to keep Savage, or the other way around. It was all part of, you know, the ideology of, you know, the old West of trying to extract resources, or versus the what they call the new West, where you try to restore nature and then have an economy based on rafting and fly fishing and this kind of thing. So it had a bearing in the sense of it being a wider battle, and a lot of the comments that you would see from people who wanted to keep Savage would say that they thought we should finish Elk Creek as well. I'd say really it got down to the idea of people seeing controlling the river and doing the things that dams did as their priority versus people who saw free-flowing rivers and salmon as the priority.
Well, it's interesting to note again, and it was quite a refreshing review of the whole Grants Pass Irrigation District and Savage Rapids Dam story in a chapter. But Curry, Jackson, and Josephine County commissioners all went on record to keep the dam, mm-hmm. at least at one point. So what finally undid things?
Well, I would point to two things. One of them is really simply a matter of dollars and cents, that the irrigation district was not going to be able to pay the extra money to put in all the different mitigation that they needed to keep their dam. It was cheaper to to put in pumps to get the same water out of the same river and put it in the same canals and irrigate the same lawns while taking out the dam, especially since they had, once they joined forces with the environmentalists, a pretty good chance of getting public money, federal money, to do that, and so not having to have their patrons have to pay. So that was one thing. The other thing was that the Southern Oregon, Northern California coho salmon was listed as endangered in 1997, which brought the federal government into matters and made the fate of the dam that much more dire, with the idea that potentially if they didn't mitigate, they could be found in violation of the Endangered Species Act and have to pay, at least in theory, great big fines if fish were found to be harmed by the dam. So I would say that those things pushed it over. And also, but aside from that, honestly, a sense of exhaustion, really, that a lot of the people who'd been involved in it had put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, as well as time and money, into fighting it out, and there was really not much of any other direction to go than to figure out how to take out the dam and keep the district going.
Let's take a call here. We have Grumpy John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Brewitt, the author of Same River Twice. Hi, Grumpy John.
Thank you, Jeff. Hey, Jeff, I've got a couple of friends who are on that irrigation district. They are treated with contempt by the people running the thing. I have never understood why, with the amount of money paid for electricity and pumps, they couldn't have hired people to hand carry the fish over the dam and give them a pedicure at the same time. It just doesn't make any sense that they couldn't have kept a gravity flow system that contributes to the water table, doesn't have to be a totally agriculturally done system. They're just being mistreated and charged huge amounts of money, and the water flow is arbitrary and stupid. They'll turn it off at ridiculous times. I mean, I just don't get how they can justify putting that continuing huge electrical expense instead of making it work with a fish ladder.
All right, so thanks for the perspective. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, first of all, I think that it would be tough to get funding for the pedicures, but the cost of power of running the pumps was one of the issues that the district had. It's true. The dam essentially provided its own power to send water out. I haven't seen the price of power or the rates the patrons are paying or anything, you know, in the last few years, so I can't speak to that specifically, except to say that fish passage only can work so well and requires a lot of maintenance, and the Savage Rapids by now would be just about 100 years old. So the prospects of continuously maintaining clear fish ladders and so on, as well as maintaining the rest of the dam, would have been a lot. If you pencil it out now, whether it would have been more cost-effective to do that than to pay for whatever they're paying for power, I couldn't say. But at the time, it didn't seem like it, and they had to make the best decision they could.
Yeah, it really was a dinosaur. I remember talking to some of the operators of the dam about it. I mean, it was not hydroelectric. It was hydromechanical, and the systems had not been renewed since basically 1920, or at least nothing new had been built like that since around that time.
Yeah. I mean, they had a couple of times where some work had been done on it. But really, overall, I mean, machinery breaks down. The workings of the dam would have needed a lot of investment, you know, even if there had been no controversy over removal.
And here again, people talked about the Savage Rapids would contribute a lot of sediment to the Rogue, that it wouldn't have the fish coming in that great. And of course, one of the things I heard a lot at the time covering the story was, you remove that flat water lake, A, we're not going to have water skiing, B, our property values will go down. Mm. Those of us who own property along the lake that then turned into a river, what did you see about any of those issues afterward?
Well, the sediment was a real fear, but I had never heard anything other than the studies indicating that it was perfectly clean and fine, and so it seems like that's fine. I mean, early on, my understanding is that some of the sediment moved slower than they would have liked, but as far as it being toxic or anything like that, I haven't seen any such thing. Property values are always an interesting thing. If you build your house next to a lake that is intended for irrigation, it's a little bit of an open question what the irrigation district owes to you and your property value. I mean, you put it there next to their house, or you bought the property next to their lake. There weren't too many houses along Savage Rapids. There were a couple of businesses. I don't remember seeing that any of them failed or collapsed. In other places in the country where that's more of an issue, it seems like what a lot of it gets down to is what happens after. Do you, the property owner, get the strip of land leading to the new shore of the river, the new bank of the river, and now instead of having lakeside property, you've got a trout stream or whatever it is. So if that's the case, people's property values may not go down at all. Now, whether that's the property that the landowner wants or not is another matter. But this is a case where it gets to an interesting conflict in almost any dam issue. The river and the water are public. They belong to the state, and everybody gets rights to use them. The dam is private and is run according, you know, mostly to the wishes of whoever owns the dam. So when property owners or people who want to water ski get caught in the middle of that, where does responsibility lie, and what are they owed? There's no quick answer.
Mm-hmm. You know, two more dams have been removed from the Rogue upstream mm-hmm. since that time, and that's not even accounting the destruction of Elk Creek Dam. Is the Rogue River something of a record holder?
I've wondered about that because it's true that in the Rogue Basin as a whole, I mean, there are a lot of little dams in the different tributaries and so on. I'll say this. When I mapped out dam removals in the Northwest, which in this case includes Northern California because they have some of the same salmon issues that Oregon and Washington do, I'm aware that people might not want California to be considered Northwestern, but for my purposes, they were. The Rogue had a bigger cluster of known removals than any other stream anywhere near its size. I mean, if you counted the Columbia, then yes, there have been a lot of dam removals in the Columbia Basin, but that's not the same thing. So yeah, the Rogue is. I remember talking to an ODF&W guy once who told me the Rogue is a target-rich environment for restoration. But I'm not sure why the Rogue and not the Umpqua or something like that.
I should point out, too, that people want to get a look at graphically at dam removals. If they can go to sciencebase.gov/drip. For the dam removal information portal. I had a chance to look at that yesterday, and it names dam by dam, and you see some figures on dam construction and removal. I wanted to ask I don't have really time to talk about the Marmot Dam in the Portland area, but do the former dam sites end up looking a little messy and muddy for years afterward, Peter?
The short answer is no. The former lake bed revegetates pretty fast. A lot depends, really, though, on how much follow-through there is on the part of the restorationists. You usually get a fair number of folks who want to remove the dam and have more fish. But if care is taken to make sure that the lake bed revegetates with whatever native species would have been there anyways, if people count the fish that are coming up and measure the quality of the water and so on, that's a big difference between being able to prove that there was success or find useful mistakes, if there were mistakes, versus kind of not knowing. And a lot of the time, the funding only goes through a short time after the removal. But as far as the way that it looks, the aesthetics, which matters politically, no. The mud almost always sprouts and becomes part of the riverbank.
So I'm curious, since you and Kim are both involved with, have spent some time and attention on the Klamath River, if you're thinking of a book on the Klamath Dam removal process, whichever way it turns, once that's all done with.
I think it'd have to be several books out there. It would be great, but one of the reasons I turned away from doing my doctoral work on the Klamath was I wanted to complete my doctoral work in a timely way, and the Klamath is a long process. Speaking more seriously, though, in terms of the size of the issue, the complexity of the engineering and so on, the Klamath is really a step beyond pretty much any other dam removal issue in the West.
Yeah, we're talking four very big dams, the three big ones anyway, and a smaller one. Same River Twice, The Politics of Dam Removal and River Restoration is the book by Peter Brewitt. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
All right, take care.